Hi, I'm Steve Clemens, and I have a question. With special interest groups pouring more than $1 billion into the midterm U.S. elections next month, has big money become a threat to American democracy? Let's get to the bottom line. The amount of money flowing in from billionaires and huge lobbying groups to fund candidates running in next month's midterm elections busted all previous records. $1.3 billion and counting. That's a big number. On the one hand, it's not under the table. That's how campaign financing works in the U.S., enshrined by a Supreme Court ruling called Citizens United in 2010. But it begs a question. Is all this money pulling lawmakers away from the will of the majority and into the narrow interests of their donors and friends? Will billionaires have an outsized ability to control the policy agenda? And does anyone see this as a threat to the future of representative democracy? Today, we're talking with Trevor Potter, the former chairman of the Federal Election Commission and current president of the Campaign Legal Center here in Washington, D.C., and Andrew Gumbel, journalist and author of Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me. Trevor, let me just start with you. The Brennan Center in New York ran numbers for this election season and found that there are just 12 mega donors, and this is remarkable, but 12 mega donors, eight of them are billionaires, have paid $1 out of every $13 spent in this election cycle. 12 people versus 170 million people are sort of saying, and I just want to kind of understand this scale of something you live and breathe, you and Andrew Gumbel both, but I'm not used to seeing these numbers. It's an extraordinary level of billionaire engagement.
It is an extraordinary level. I was looking at some of the numbers. Open Secrets has a good list of people who have spent. The top 10 people spent $500 million, just an unbelievable sum. And they are, sort of like horse race owners. They're backing specific candidates. They're winning primaries by... Peter Thiel spent enormous sums of money to make sure J.D. Vance was the Republican nominee in Ohio. It's backing a prize fighter or something like that. And we just haven't seen that before. Steve, about 10 years ago, I was asked by a German television producer if I would like to comment on the role of the oligarchs. And I said, well, I'm really a specialist in American elections. I don't know much about Russia. And he said, no, I mean the American oligarchs. And that was a shocking phrase at the time. I hadn't thought of it that way. We've always had people who have supported party committees, but we haven't had, up until the last couple years, and really on show this year, people who sort of go off freelancing on their own, decide which candidates they want to see in the Senate or governorship, and then simply finance their races. And that is a role that I think excludes ordinary citizens. We look at this money being spent and think, well, they're picking the candidates and ultimately the office holders. And even though we know this money is being spent because we see contributions to various groups, it's important to remember that a lot of this is essentially secret money, because when you see a television ad, it doesn't say paid for by Peter Thiel or paid for by George Soros or who, because both parties are being supported, but candidates of both parties by these individuals. Instead, it says something like paid for by Americans for a Better Country. And you have no idea who that is. Yes, groups like the Brennan Center or Open Secrets can report on these overall totals, but it is hard to know exactly where the money is going, because a lot of it is going to groups that don't disclose their donors. And then the advertising itself doesn't tell you who pays for it. So the American public is really left in the dark, except for shows like this and discussions like this, about who is financing, running which candidates.
Well, thank you for that. Well, Andrew Gumbel, you've been writing about America's oligarchs. You've been writing about Peter Thiel in a fascinating article called Peter Thiel's Midterm Bet, The Billionaire Seeking to Disrupt America's Democracy. And I'm really interested in trying to get an understanding. Has it become a dynamic where one party says, hey, I've got, I'll meet your billionaire and I'll double with two? I mean, is this become so normalized, as you write about, that we're just beginning to accept the fact that large financial players are legitimate in the American political system, should have sway, should be able, as Trevor Potter said, just simply to pick candidates and prize fighters? What's your take on this?
Well, the way you framed it is interesting, because I think that the notion that the parties are in charge of who runs and wins elections and then what happens once they get into office is being challenged in and of itself, that I think that the big money is talking louder than the parties in many important respects. You know, to come back to another one of your premises from earlier, I think, you know, the basic point to make is that if individuals are putting in this vast amount of money into the political system, they expect something for their money. And what they get for their money is not only the candidates of their choice prevailing in primaries, having huge financial advantages going into the general election, if that's the case, because as you point out, there's fundraising on both sides. But it's also about determining the policy agenda. And that happens outside of the context of elections as well as within the context of elections. So to just give one very brief example of what I mean, the huge amount of money that was put into Republican Party politics, starting with the Koch brothers after about 2008, has all but eliminated the possibility for the Republicans as a party to talk about climate change as a real and present threat that we need to confront as a matter of policy urgency. If you look at a country like Britain, where there are certainly very conservative people in the Conservative Party, there is still an open debate about how to deal with climate change that crosses both parties. That's not a coincidence. It's about the money. You see that in other ways as well. And it's not just about what doesn't get discussed by one party. It can often be about what doesn't get discussed by anyone, especially in the context of an election. Because if you know that a mega donor can drop $1 or $5 or $10 million against you if you talk about a certain subject, you know, maybe it's student debt relief and defending President Biden's plan for that. Maybe it's, you know, some other area of fiscal policy or something else that is of direct benefit to ordinary voters but threatens the interests of a narrow band of very rich people. You're going to be very deterred from raising that on the campaign trail because you don't want $10 million dropping against you. So even without spending the money, there is a deterrent effect on a healthy, normal political debate where the interests of ordinary voters are being held front and center, not only by the voters themselves as they vote, but also by the candidates.
Trevor, you have been working on this issue longer than anyone I know, and I'm going to tell our audience, you know, you were working closely with Senator John McCain, who himself was worried about these distortions in American politics. You've gone a long time with this, and I haven't seen progress, substantial progress, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, in transparency or beginning to raise this issue of what it's doing to corrode democracy. What does it say to a young person when you say to them, be engaged in politics, get engaged in the parties, try to make the world a better place, but you're so outgunned and outmanned, depending on where the billionaires are stacking their chips? But I'm just interested, as you know, because you do know this area well, you know, what should give us concern, and do you see any hope in this work on looking at, you know, building a better campaign legal infrastructure and financing infrastructure than what we have today?
Well, unfortunately, throughout my professional career, I started with the presidential campaign of the first president, George H.W. Bush, then was at the Federal Election Commission. It's not my fault, I promise you, but throughout that career, things have gotten significantly worse, I think, for the American public in terms of how we finance elections. When I started, we had a public funding system for the presidency. And candidates raised money, and it was matched in the primaries, the general election. They had full public funding. They didn't take private contributions. In terms of the House and Senate and the party committees, there were strict limits on how much individuals could give to candidates and to the committees. And there weren't the runarounds, the workarounds that now dominate the system, so that there was full disclosure. People knew who was giving, and they were giving in relatively small amounts. The amount that a wealthy individual could give to a candidate was $1,000 per election. That has changed over time, not really because the limits have gone up much, they have a little, but because the money is going around those limits. The ability of wealthy individuals to come in, bankroll a candidate, do so either overtly or covertly, sort of pick their horse and ride it, and put them in office, is totally different from what it was. And I think Andrew is also right that the threat of that to office holders is a huge problem. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse has just written a book talking about what he sees as the corruption inherent in all of this and the ability to shape legislation, which is, after all, why people spend money on politics, is they want particular outcomes, or as Andrew points out, they want to block particular outcomes. And so when you have literally tens of millions of dollars, all these top donors that we're talking about have given 25, 50 more million dollars in this race. When you have that kind of money, it's very difficult for the average citizen to counteract. It's very difficult for the parties. They end up as, to some extent, the hostages of wealthy individuals. If the candidate doesn't do what they want, the individual will cut their support. If the wealthy individual, the special interests, are bankrolling candidates around the parties, outside of the party structure, the party really doesn't have much say in that. So the world has changed significantly. I think a lot of this goes back to the Supreme Court Citizens United decision. I say that because the court really there gave a green light to spending unlimited amounts of money in elections. Now, technically, it was just corporate money, then labor money that's being spent. But I think the fact that the disclosure system has not worked the way it is supposed to is an enormous problem here. When John McCain was working on the McCain-Feingold law, part of that was to limit the ability of wealthy special interests to spend money by requiring disclosure so that citizens would know who was paying for those ads. And in Citizens United itself, Justice Kennedy said, yes, it's true, for the first time we're going to allow unlimited corporate money in federal elections, but don't worry because it'll be fully disclosed and shareholders will be able to hold their corporations accountable for how they spend their money, and citizens will know who is paying for the advertising and therefore can judge the advertising based on the source of the money. As Andrew says, if it's a energy company spending money urging you to elect someone, you can make your own decisions about whether you agree with that energy company. But that's not what we have. We have a situation where the money is often routed through nonprofit organizations that don't disclose donors. And the result is that citizens are seeing all these ads. They're aware there's a lot of money being spent out there, but they don't really know who it's coming from. So you have these independent actors who are essentially supplanting the party committees, particularly in things like Senate races, where you spend $30 million, you're spending 10 times what a party committee would spend.
Right. Andrew, I'd love to get your take as well on this, but wondering, from maybe a devil's advocate position, saying, well, the American system in a way responded with something I was surprised by, particularly as we saw in the Obama campaigns and the Bernie Sanders campaigns and, the rise of the small donor, the $3 donor, the $2 donor, massive amounts of money, which in a way kind of gave me hope that there were that many people out there giving in small donors that it could make a difference. But in the real world, does that small level donor, in which we've seen proliferate because technology allows us to do that, to get past postage stamps and mailers, is that a counter effect that balances the abuses perhaps of, the billionaire crowd essentially in politics?
Well, first of all, I'd say that the rise of the small donor movement, if you want to call it that, is a direct response to a universal, I would say, disgust at the level of unaccountable money sloshing around the system. if you look around the country where there have been successful campaigns, usually through state-level ballot initiatives, to counter certain aspects of what, you know, I would call the corruption of the system, whether it's gerrymandering seats, whether it's campaign finance that allows unlimited donations to independent groups, you see that, you know, those ballot initiatives succeed in red states as well as blue states. Groups like Represent Us have been very active in trying to make that happen. So I think what you see is that if you scratch the average American voter and get them to sort of stop their polarizing us versus them team sports view of how American politics works, there's a tremendous amount of agreement that the system is corrupt and that it needs to be reformed. Now, the question is, how do you do that? The small donor approach is one that can work, but it does generally require a candidate in a race that has tremendous media visibility. Mm. It's not something that's going to work for the average school board race, for example, or something else, you know, maybe a water board where there's a direct interest of an energy company to get involved. Then you have, you know, an argument we've seen many times, most notably with Donald Trump, but not just with him. People from the business world saying, well, I have lots of money of my own, so I can't be corrupted. I think that's a very problematic argument. The fact is, in politics, you know, you are beholden to people for reasons that have to do with money, but also have to do with many other things. And as we saw with Donald Trump, you know, he ended up pursuing an agenda that was very friendly to the people who he felt were vital to his political interests, you know, whether it's evangelical Christians with the abortion issue or the Federalist Society on the nomination of judges and so on and so forth. So this argument that, well, I've got so much money that I can't be corrupted, I think is a false one. And what we're seeing now with people like Peter Thiel jumping in is a very explicit let's tear everything down kind of argument. So it's taking the previous arguments and pushing them to another level, saying the system is so corrupt, we need to destroy everything. And the contradiction in what he's doing, of course, is that if the analysis that most Americans can get behind is that the unaccountable money and corruption is the problem in our system, then having somebody who is a billionaire pouring tens of millions of dollars into races to back candidates who don't believe in American democracy is not the answer. And I think it's interesting that we now have in Peter Thiel a mega donor who explicitly has raised doubts about the democratic system, working within the new limits or lack of limits of a system where money can trump ordinary people's votes. The reason why all this money exists is because money can be more powerful than people's votes.
Right.
So it is inherently undemocratic. And now we're seeing explicit calls to tear down the institutions of our democratic system coming from those same donors who are taking advantage
right.
of a system that's become too loose.
Well, you know, this raises the important question, Trevor, of, you know, what to do. I mean, you and I both, I will say this publicly, we're friends with Madeleine Albright. Madeleine Albright wrote a book on fascism and said oftentimes fascists are elected in systems. And I'm, you know, as I listen to Andrew saying, you know, very clearly that we have a democratic system electing people who are opposed to democracy. We have a system with Citizens United creating the trappings of non-transparency, as you said. I guess my question to you is, you know, do you look at campaign finance as the greatest threat to American democracy now? And what is the strategy to get us onto a different track?
I think there are a number of dangerous threats to democracy now. The money in politics is part of it, but it's really an indicia of what's going on. It's this overall attack, as Andrew was mentioning, in the institution of democracy itself, the idea that we somehow can't govern ourselves, that individual Americans can't be trusted. When I hear somebody like Peter Thiel talking about, you know, destroying the system, breaking it down, starting again, not trusting what we have, I end up thinking, well, he's protected by billions of dollars of personal wealth. So, you know, however much chaos we have and however bad things are, he's probably okay. But what about the rest of us? When you hear the Republican leadership in Congress talking about defaulting on our debt and the potential global calamitous financial results of that, Again, it may serve a partisan interest, but it's not very good for the country. So I think the attacks on the integrity of election officials, the threats to election officials, everything I've seen says that they're officials who are leaving their office, if they're in office or they're not volunteering because they fear violence and threats at the polls. That's dangerous for democracy. The whole thing we've heard for 2 years about how elections are fraudulent and rigged and you can't trust one type of voting or another type of voting, and the certified winner isn't somehow really the winner. All of that is dangerous for democracy because it leaves voters feeling that somehow the system is not secure. And Steve, remember that when we talk about voters putting people in power, you start with the fact that in most states you have primaries for each party with very small turnout. So if somebody wins a primary 35% to 33%, we're talking about a couple thousand votes then ending up deciding who the party nominee is. And in the House and the Senate, many of these are very safe seats. So the election is actually decided there. So, and then you have the big chunk of the country who don't even vote on election day.
Right.
So it's a small piece that end up deciding who we're going to have in office. And if that small piece is bought by really wealthy special interests, then they're beholden to them when they get there. And those interests don't like democracy. That's a problem.
Just in the last minute we have, Andrew, two of the acolytes of Peter Thiel are Blake Masters, who's running for Senate in Arizona, and J.D. Vance, who's running for Senate in Ohio. Should they win, is the practice that you've been sort of, you know, putting a spotlight on going to get much worse in the future?
I think that it's going to get worse regardless of whether they win or not. I think that is the real problem, that, you know, to Trevor's point, we now have a primary system where very small groups of voters who can be more easily swayed by the big money interests are deciding who gets to run. And the fact that you now have, you know, Masters and Vance, and before them you have people who are already in the Senate, like Ted Cruz or Josh Hawley, who are on the very far right of the party, who believe in being gadflies, who believe in, you know, pushing against everything that has been held sacred by the Republicans, never mind the Senate itself in the past. This creates an atmosphere in which these candidates with these views become the norm, and that we can expect a lot more of them in the future.
Well, listen, thank you. Fascinating conversation, important conversation on what, you know, the solvency of American democracy is today. Trevor Potter, former chairman of the Federal Election Commission and current president of the Campaign Legal Center, and Andrew Gumbel, journalist and author. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you, Steve.
So what's the bottom line? If your idea of American politics is based on the Hollywood classic, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington with Jimmy Stewart, you're seriously in need of a software update. That sort of thinking, an upstanding American citizen decides that his voice or her voice is worth something and should be heard, so they launch a campaign with almost no money, but people love them and they vote for them, and then they wind up in Congress and they stand up for the little guy. If that movie was adapted for today, at the end, Mr. Smith would wake up realizing that his whole adventure was just a front for a billionaire pulling strings from behind with tens of millions of dollars spent in political action committees with virtually no transparency. Big money and big power are the name of the game in today's America. There are a lot of David and Goliath standoffs in American politics today, but usually Goliath wins. There are folks out there who still are brave enough to run for public office and sincerely want to serve their constituencies, but it's getting harder and harder to break through the money barrier. And that's the bottom line.